This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 129. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm Jim Harmer, your host, and today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, all sitting down virtually in our earbuds as you're sweating it out on the treadmill or you're commuting, doing whatever it is, listening to the podcast. And today I'm joined by Darren Meller and Brian McGuckin, and also three of the listeners of the Improved Photography Podcast for the first time ever, all in one room. So this is good. This is like the live edition of the podcast. So Darren and Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, we are in Chicago at the Out of Chicago Photography Conference, and we got to meet up with about 20 of the listeners of the podcast last night. We went on a photo walk, and we've been just shooting up Chicago before the conference. And so, Brian, last night we were out yesterday morning we were out shooting the Bean. Tell us about shooting the Bean. I've seen photos of it before, and every time I see a photo of it, I just wonder, like, what am I even looking at? It's just like this giant reflective mirror orb statue in the middle of Chicago. So tell me about it.
Yeah, well, I love Chicago. Chicago's like my home away from home. And the Bean is exactly that. It's a bean. It's a big mirror bean. And so when you hear of the Bean and you're looking for something called that, you look for a big bean. And so yeah, that's
so
what
like
it is.
It's like a giant ball, like 20 feet tall, 40 feet long, whatever that is in meters, like 6-8 meters tall, whatever it is. And so it's just a big mirror ball on the ground in the middle of the park.
Yeah, and the best thing about it is the reflections. You've got hundreds of people standing around taking pictures of themselves reflecting in it. The skyline is in the background reflecting in it as well. And so it's a very popular location in Chicago for people to come and shoot. And I've shot it a few times before, but I've always tried to get the people out of it. And it's difficult to do. So what I've done in the past is gone there at nighttime and do a long exposure and just sat there and hope that people would keep on moving. Because obviously if they don't move, they're going to be in the photo. But if they do move, they don't show up.
Yeah, they're in the photo twice because you see them standing there and their reflection on the orb.
Right, exactly. So during the day, obviously you can't do a long exposure like that. So we were talking about one of the tips that you had that was on the Improved Photography website, and you had the nine weird tips and tricks that actually work, and one of them deals with deleting tourists from travel photos. So what we did was I set up my tripod and kept it in one spot, and I took a photo and then waited a few seconds, took another photo, and I just did it sporadically depending on when people were moving. Now there were some groups that would stay in a spot for a little bit and then they would eventually move, and so whenever they would move, I'd try to take another shot. And so I would end up having about 20 to 30 photos hopefully.
And the photos were how far apart? You know, were you taking like just a burst of 20 photos, or like how far apart were each of the pictures?
If a lot of people were moving, I would, if there were a couple times where there was like nobody in the main area, so I just took like 5 shots in a row to have a few good solid ones of those. But a lot of people like to conjugate underneath the bean because you kind of can walk under it. And so that was the area I kept waiting for people to move.
And whenever, we found a little trick the night before about how to get rid of those people, by the way. Every day when there were just people that, because as long as people keep moving during the photo, it's fine, right? Because you take a picture when they move and then we'll cut them out. But when somebody would just stay there for a long time, it was a problem. So Brian would sit there at the camera and I just went over and stood awkwardly close to people and suddenly they'd move. It was great.
It was, and I appreciated your willingness to do that for me.
you offered to go in and make yourself throw up in the middle so everybody could clear out. That would have been even better.
Hey, and later in the day I actually offered to go into there and pass gas. I thought that might work as well.
And clear them out.
So I appreciate the things that you guys are willing to sacrifice for me and my shots. But so after I felt like I got enough shots where hopefully there was an empty spot, so to say, for each of the areas to where it looked like there wasn't somebody there in that same spot for all my photos, then I had all the shots that I needed, which a couple times it was 20 to 30 photos maybe even 40 photos at one time. And then later on when we came back, I just, you know, put the photos on my computer, and then I went to the link that you had about the tips and tricks and just followed that. And it was simple. You know, you open up Photoshop and you go to File, then Scripts, then Statistics. From there, you choose the median and you select the files that I took, which were about 20 photos, I think is what I ended up choosing and using. And clicked go and just waited. And for me, it was a matter of a couple minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and it was done. And for the most part, everybody was out of the photo. Mm-hmm. The area underneath the bean where people kind of stood the longest, you could kind of see there was some, it almost looked like trees,
yeah,
you know, underneath there. But I could clean that up more in Photoshop if I wanted to spend the time on it. And it just, it is amazing because you look at that shot and you're like, wait, when we were there, there were hundreds of people around it, mm-hmm, and you don't see them at all in the photo. And
yeah,
all I had to do.
It's really cool.
Yeah, and I didn't have to spend the time of erasing all these people in Photoshop.
Mm-hmm.
I just followed that, those tips, and it worked, and it did it all for me.
Yeah, it's cool when you're looking at it in Photoshop and you see the hundreds of people in the photo, and then it's running, churning through the photos, and then about 2 minutes later when it finishes, just boom, just everybody's gone all of a sudden. It's really cool. I tried it with 40 photos to see if we could get better results, and it just locked up the computer for like half an hour, and it never even finished it. It's on my laptop. That's a decent laptop, but yeah, for that kind of thing, it just wasn't enough. But I was wondering about if you can. So then I switched it to just 20 photos like you did, and it, you know, it was real quick and it finished it out. But what I was wondering if you could do to clean up that area where it wasn't quite perfect is get the finished result and then save that out and then add that in with another 10 photos. And I wonder if you do it kind of in batches like that, if you could get it totally perfect. But I like you said, it was pretty close. It was close enough for me, but I guess if you wanted to, that might be interesting to try. So that was pretty cool. Darren, tell us about shooting on the bridge last night.
Yeah, we had some really great lighting last night. The sun was setting over by the Trump Plaza building, and the bridge was just vibrating like crazy. It's this big, huge suspension bridge of some sort, and it has one of the best views if you're looking towards downtown Chicago where the sun's setting. And it was just extremely hard to be able to get the shots within the time frame. Like, my dad and I forgot to bring our tripods, so we had to rely on the image stabilization in his lens and not rely on the image stabilization in mine. But I just kind of exhaled a little bit. Real evenly, and then just fired a burst mode to get some shots in there that were actually clear and crisp. Otherwise, the sharpness would have just not have been there. But it was just shaking like mad.
Yeah, it was an awesome composition. So we were looking over the river, and there, you know, these tall skyscrapers just lining either side. And so as it gets further away, it looks like it's, you know, it's like a forming a perfect V down to the, was it the Trump building at the very end? Whatever the building was at the very
end. Yeah, yep, the Donald building.
Yeah, the Donald building. Who's running for president now? I don't think that stands a flying chance. Oh man, who would vote for Donald Trump for president? Anyway, so it was an awesome shoot, and it was, there was a little bit of cloud in the sky, just enough color to make it interesting. But like you said, just that vibration, I had a hard time. So I ended up shooting it at f/2.8, which isn't enough for a landscape, but you know, you got to make a sacrifice somewhere. When, you know, when it's dark and the bridge is moving, you can't go to a long shutter speed. You don't want the ISO too high. You got to do something. Something's got to give. And so I shot it at f/2.8, and I really wish I would have thought, I don't know why I wasn't thinking of it, but after we went to dinner and we were walking back, I thought, dang, why didn't I just focus stack it? So take a picture focused, you know, shallow, then a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further, you know, 5 pictures, and then stack those together in Photoshop. It'll do it automatically for you, grabbing the sharpest part of the image. And then even though I shot at f/2.8, I could get everything in sharp depth of field. But fortunately, there was nothing too close to the camera, and so it worked out okay. It wasn't the best. I wish I could go back and try that one over again, get my mulligan there, but I think it turned out just fine. And then also we shot the famous Chicago theater sign, and Brian and I were out at night, and there was this woman who was way high on drugs. I mean, she was way high the night before, and she was just laughing like for 20 minutes straight. She was just laughing. It was sad, and it also just made us keep laughing the whole time. It was really fun. So we shot there for a while, and what we were doing is getting the Chicago Theater sign, but also trying to get the trails of the tail lights of cars driving past on the street. And so that was pretty cool. I realized the cool tip there, that usually when we think of exposure, it's the overall exposure. And it doesn't matter if you use a longer shutter speed or a higher ISO, both of them are just going to make the picture brighter. But what I did is I kept my ISO at 100, as low as it goes, and I had a long shutter speed of like 20 seconds to get the right exposure. And then the problem we were having with that is the tail lights of the cars driving past were just super, super dim. And so what I realized is even though the overall exposure was right, I could brighten up just the tail lights of the cars by shortening my shutter speed to just the time it takes for the car to actually pass through the frame, which is about 3 seconds, but then increasing my ISO. Because what was happening is the rest of the scene was getting a great exposure from the 30 second shutter speed, but since the car was only there for a second, it was just super, super dim. And I'd never really thought about it that way. Maybe I was the last to think about it, but I had never quite realized that until I made that switch, and it was really helpful.
What camera settings did you use, Brian? Because I think someone told me that she used f/22 at one point in time.
Yeah, that was yesterday during the day. We went back to that same spot, and it was a lot brighter out. It was earlier in the day, so I had f/22. My shutter speed on that obviously was going to determine what I could get, and so I had my ISO was at 100, and I believe I was trying it around 3 seconds.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and it was a lot brighter then. Often when we're shooting like in the city where there are city lights, or in Italy, there were several places where, you know, it's kind of the city lights during the blue hour. And the time that I'm always waiting for, we were there a little bit too early at the Chicago sign. The time that I'm always waiting for is when the sky is the same exposure as the city lights on. Because otherwise, you take a picture and the building looks really cool, but the sky is just really bright and it takes your eye up to the sky, or the sky is just pitch black. And when it's just black in the city, just pitch black sky, it's just not as interesting. I at least like to see a little bit of that moody midnight blue kind of sky in the background. So, you know, even though you're shooting night photography, doesn't mean you can just shoot at whatever time of the night you feel like. Just like during the day, the light changes when you're at night. And so even with night photography, you still have to kind of time out the light a little bit. It's not just a free-for-all.
And you could actually go at any time of the night, but you're going to miss a lot of the character.
And the light's just going to change, you know. Maybe if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't mean the sky's bad. It just means, you know, maybe we're going to have to switch and include some of the stars now. Or, and even the position of the moon can really affect where the shadows are in the scene. And so you got to kind of watch the position of the moon. It's not that you can't shoot through the night. It's that just like during the day, the light's going to be changing, and you just have to watch it and plan what you're shooting according to that.
Another thing that I've noticed is the in cities, the light impacts a lot down the streets, because the light can reflect off the buildings. Mm-hmm. And so at night, you can also have that if one building, like where we were with the Chicago Theater, there's a lot of light on that side. And so it also can reflect from the buildings across the street. So it just gives it a different look.
That's a good point. And the first night we were here, Brian and I climbed up. We rode the elevator up the Sears Tower, the Willis Tower, up to the very top. And there's a sky deck there where people are there. And it's all glass all around. You're just in this on the level 103 of this super tall building, and so you're shooting through glass, and so it was kind of hard to get the reflections out. Fortunately, the lights were low in the actual room, because so when you're shooting through glass, the trick is you want to make sure that nothing touches, none of the light comes in from the side of the lens. And so Brian, I think, got his shirt and kind of wrapped it around the lens to cut out reflections and glare, and then you just want to get your lens, the glass of your lens, touching the glass of the window, so you can cut out all the reflections as much as possible, at least. And we got some pretty cool shots up there. I shot a little time lapse on my iPhone. I had a little tripod that I set up, and just shooting down on the city was a pretty cool thing. What was your favorite shot so far of the places we've shot? Did you like the Sears Tower or some of the places in the city?
My favorite, the tower is nice. I don't get why the sky deck is on the wrong side of the building.
It
in
is,
my
huh?
opinion. I love the Bean, and I love the Chicago Theater. Those are classic. Navy Pier also, we really haven't gone out to it. Mm-hmm. We shot fireworks last night, which were in that area, which was kind of fun, but Navy Pier is a spot that I like to shoot as well.
Very cool. Well, we want to go on to talk to some of the listeners of the podcast and get a few of their questions. But first, before we do that, we want to take just 1 second and talk about our survey for the podcast. You know that the way that we keep this podcast free, and we have for, I think, 2 years now, is by having advertising on the podcast that now supports all the new shows we have and people on the shows. And so I would ask if you just take 1 second and go to podcastsurvey.com/improve, and there we have a survey, if it just demographic information that we can use for advertisers so we can keep our ads relevant to the show. That's podcastsurvey.com/improve. Okay, let's go on and talk to a few of the listeners that we have here and get some of the questions from you guys.
All right, I'll hand it on over to Amber.
Hi guys, I'm glad to be here. You guys were talking about shooting from the sky deck and not letting any of the light through by using your shirt. Where is the focus point when you're focusing out through glass? I had heard that you focus out past the glass, so you can actually just blur out the beginning of the glass, kind of like when you do with chain link fences, when you're shooting past those. Is that where you want to focus?
Well, when you're shooting, you've got the lens right up to the glass, so it's just as if there's just another piece of glass on the lens. So really, you're focusing on the buildings. When you're up that high, the aperture is not going to make that much of a difference because everything is pretty far away. So, and depending on if you have a tripod and all, I tend to focus at right, just whatever's in the middle of all the buildings, but you've got your lens right up to the glass. So, you know, focusing through the glass, it's just like it's another piece of glass over the lens.
Yeah. In fact, you may have an advantage by shooting at f2.8 or whatever your lowest aperture is, f5.6, depending on your lens. Because I noticed when I did try to shoot at f16, I could see little gnats and bugs crawling on the outside of the glass and the dirt on the glass. And if you shoot at f2.8, you have less depth of field, so that glass that's close to you is gone. And like Brian said, it really doesn't matter what aperture you use for the city, because the city's far away. You're on the 103rd floor, and so the city's far away. It doesn't matter if you use f2.8 or f22. You're focused at infinity. Everything's at infinity, so it doesn't really matter what your aperture is. The only thing it matters for is getting through that glass, and I found f2.8 to work best there.
And does that impact the reflections on the light on the water at all?
No, shouldn't make any difference.
Okay. I was just curious about also, just kind of off the topic, but can you talk about ring lights and the benefits and drawbacks?
Yeah. So a ring light is just a flash that, or it's a flash modifier that's in the shape of a circle. It's a ring, right? And so a lot of them are made for speed lights. So you'll just stick a regular old speed light into the bottom of it, and then it's a plastic piece that just forms a complete circle. It's not a, it's a ring, I guess. It's not a circle. So the middle of it is hollow. So the way that a ring light is typically used is you put it around your lens as this big plastic ring, and you put it over your lens, and the idea of it is it makes completely shadowless light. So if you're using a if you're, you know, you, let's just say we put the speed light right on the camera, on camera flash. Well, it's still up just a little bit, you know, just a finger span from your lens. And that's enough to throw really hard shadows under the nose, on the side of the nose, etc. And so the ring flash, because it goes all the way around the lens, the light is evenly coming from every angle around the lens. It means there, it's impossible for there to be any shadow when you have a ring light on. So it's really interesting lighting to use. It's often used for macro photography, if you're taking a picture of a flower or something, so that you, because it's such a small thing, a flower or an insect, that if you have a shadow, it's going to be a long, long shadow. And so a ring flash is often used for macro photography, but it's also become kind of in vogue to use for portrait photography. It's a little bit of a gimmick. Usually when I see somebody that buys a ring flash, like all of their portraits become ring flash shots for the next 6 months. And I don't know, it's interesting. I've used one before. A company's sent one out to me before that I tried, and it is a fun effect. And there are times that it's a great tool, but don't let that be your first flash modifier by any means. I think it's one to wait on. It's kind of a special effect kind of thing that is cool and does have a good place to use, but I wouldn't use it exactly every day either. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you can also tell if a photo was taken with one by looking in the eyes. Uh-huh. Right? Do you
see
the ring?
Yeah, big ring, yeah.
In the eyes.
Yeah. Which is sometimes cool. And you don't have to use it over your lens. You can take it off, take that ring flash off the camera and just hold it off to the side, and you get that, I mean, it makes you look a little bit alienish when you have that ring-shaped catch light in the eye. But you know, it's different. I have seen people do some pretty cool stuff with it. But it's a special effect thing. Don't let that be your first flash modifier.
Yeah, I have seen some people in videos like cut out ring things you can put over the top of it and put little cutouts of stars or hearts that you can even do more weird stuff with to make even cooler effects in their eyes. But again, that's all in the taste of whoever's doing it.
Mm-hmm. And we had one other question that we recorded last night from somebody who couldn't be here today. I'll play that now.
This is Nelson from Chicago. My question for the podcast is, does it matter what type of raw file types you use? Lossy versus compressed, 12-bit versus 14-bit? Does it matter, and how?
Yeah, I would say that I use different types of RAW files. I like to use the highest end RAW file. I mean, you have to consider your storage space on your computer, your processing power on your computer, but most computers aren't really going to run into a problem if they're running Photoshop or Lightroom with ease. I like to use the 14-bit because you get more color variations, and I've noticed when people use the lossy versions of RAW or JPEG, you're starting to see a lot of banding in the skies, especially when the color starts to blend up from different shades of blue. And I think that's one of the largest advantages of shooting the biggest raw file possible, because you get the most color combinations per RGB.
Right. So on a lot of cameras, not all cameras, but a lot of cameras, you can set which RAW file you're shooting. Sometimes we'll have like a medium RAW in there. I don't think anybody makes a small RAW. But there's the medium RAW, or just the default. If you just turn it to RAW and you don't go into your custom functions to change it, you know, it's just going to be your regular 14-bit. On most cameras, it's going to be a 14-bit RAW file. However, on some cameras, like notably the Sony's, the A7R, for example, and the A7R II, which I pre-ordered this last week. I'm anxious to try that one out. It's 12-bit, and it's not just 12-bit, it's 12-bit lossy compressed. And really, that sounds a lot worse than it is. Why Sony chose to do that, I can't even imagine. Somebody talked to a Sony support rep on Sony Alpha rumors I was reading, and they said they are working on switching to 14-bit, but it doesn't look imminent, and the A7R II is not going to have that. So I don't know. It's one of those things that sounds bad to a nerd, and I would certainly like to see the 14-bit, but when you actually look at them side to side, I mean, we're really splitting hairs here. We're really splitting hairs. So I don't think it's anything to panic about, but I really think we should be seeing 14-bit out of Sony. I hope they change that.
for the listeners like me that have no clue what you're talking about, which is probably a lot of people, could you explain the, why does it matter? 12-bit, for like what are you talking about?
Yeah, so well, we'll put it in the simplest terms. It's how much data can be saved in the actual file, because the sensor is gaining a lot of information and the camera has to turn that into a file on your computer. And so it's just how much of that information is kept. Now, the deeper the depth, the bit depth of the photo, the more tones, the more shades you can have in the photo. And so, like Darren was saying, that often in the sky you'll see kind of weird banding kind of stuff going on. That's because there wasn't enough shades to go gradually from one shade to the other, because the sky's blue, but it's really changing very subtly between different shades of blue. And so that's one place that you may often see that. So it's just how much data is in the photo. And in a practical sense, I mean, you can't just look at a photo and like, you use 12-bit lossy? What are you thinking? You can't tell. But sometimes you'll see little things like that in a photo that can be caused from that. And it's not that a 14-bit can't have that same problem, just that it's less likely to happen.
Yeah, so, I would say it's definitely like splitting hairs. Like when you did your comparison of the 5K iMac versus the 2013 or 2014 edition.
Yeah, that was crazy,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, a lot of people couldn't tell the difference. And I think you wouldn't really be able to tell the difference on this unless you're a huge nerd. I think Jeff Harmon, if he were here with us, he would probably chime in on that as being, you know, you need to use 14-bit.
Uh-huh. So other than the file size and how much space it takes up on your card and your computer, are there any benefits to shooting 12-bit?
No. No, that's it. It just saves you a little bit of file size. And some people will turn their camera to that. I don't know. It doesn't work for me. I'm just going to keep it up all the time. You know, a file that's 10% bigger, what do I care, you know? Storage is cheap now. You can get a 3-terabyte hard drive for like $100. I mean, I'm not terribly concerned about that. But, you know, if you're really concerned about space, yeah. I guess it's something. It's something you could consider at least. But most cameras are just 14-bit, turn it to RAW, and you don't have to think about it ever again.
All right, this is back on the topic of our Chicago photo walk. We were walking, and so we were taking a lot of pictures of architecture. Chris was showing me one of the tilt-shift lenses. Could you tell me some more about that and what its applications are?
Yeah, so a tilt-shift lens is... The way that it's used is to give you one, ultimate depth of field, and two, there's no distortion, minimal distortion in the photo. And so it actually, you know, it does exactly what it says it does. You actually bend the lens up or down. There's a little wheel on the side and you turn it and it'll actually physically bend the lens just a little bit. And by doing that, you can make the buildings look straight. So let's say I'm shooting with a wide angle lens and I've turned the camera up toward the sky. Well, when I do that, all the buildings on the side of the photo look like they're leaning in, like sometimes at a 45 degree angle. And so when you're shooting in the city where there are so many tall buildings, really all you can do to get them straight with a regular lens is one, keep the buildings from getting too close to the edge of the frame, and two, never turn the camera up. If you keep your camera, you know, facing straight out, there's going to be very minimal distortion. But sometimes you want to turn the lens up and to get a view looking up at the building. And so to do that, you'd need a tilt shift lens. So you keep everything level, looking straight out, and then you crank it up, crank the front of the lens up, and then it's going to have, it's going to get rid of your distortion.
Yeah, we actually had one of the readers comment on a photo that we posted last night without a tilt shift lens, and he was saying that we should use one. And I thought to myself, well, it's kind of a niche thing. I'm not sure if I'd actually want to buy one of those. But as he mentioned and Amber mentioned, it'd be a good idea to rent one. I mean, if you're going to a city with a lot of tall buildings and you want to have that real straight perpendicular and parallel, every line being straight and have that control of depth and field, why not rent one? Borrow Lenses does a good job with those.
Yeah, and it is a good thing. The distortion bothers me a little bit less than maybe it does to some photographers. And I sometimes wonder if photographers, you know, see the buildings kind of leaning in and just because we know about it, we're like, ha, distortion, you know? Whereas a normal actual human being would look at the photo and just say, oh, that's a pretty photo, you know, just because that's how lenses work. And so people are just used to seeing that. So I don't know, a little bit of distortion on buildings doesn't really offend me like it does some people. If I lived in the city, I would probably shoot a tilt shift lens some of the times, but it's not a panacea for all city shots. Like Chris Smith, who's the organizer of the Out of Chicago conference, was saying last night, like, you know, sometimes it just looks fine without it, and not having the buildings coming in sometimes is in some shots a little bit of a disadvantage. So I think it's great if you shoot a lot in the city or you're shooting architecture, definitely something to have and use, but I don't think it's a complete replacement for all city photo shots either. And you can do special effects with them as well. You can, if you tilt it the other direction, then it gets like this miniature world look kind of thing. It looks like everything is a model because the top is blurry, and so it's something interesting. You can kind of recreate that in Photoshop, but it's something interesting at least. Well, does that do it for all our questions? Yep. All right. Well, it was good talking with you guys from Chicago, live in our hotel room.
Boom, boom, boom.
We couldn't find a quiet place, so we just all packed into our little hotel room. And we are going to go hit the city. Hopefully, wherever you are listening to the podcast, you'll break out your camera and get shooting tonight. And we'll be sharing some of the photos that we get from this trip on Facebook and on our Instagrams. My Instagram handle is Jim Harmer. Brian is Brian McGuckin.
And mine's DarrenTM08. I'm not sure where I came up with that one.
Everybody else just has a regular name. All right. So if you want to follow Darren, just look up StarChild72.
No guarantees on what you're going to find there, folks.
All right. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you in another 7 days.